This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Sally Nungesser, Republican political consultant, former press secretary to Governor David Treen, former candidate for insurance commissioner. In 1995, she lost a tough race to Jim Brown. She's here to talk about what's happening in Louisiana and in Washington. It's been quite a week. Also on the show, Sarah Broom. She is involved with a project called Thrive, a charter boarding school for at-risk students that's planted near downtown in our community. And Sarah Broom came to Baton Rouge in 2008 as part of the Teach for America group and was at Prescott Middle School. She stayed, and she's one of the Business Report's 40 Under 40. We'll talk with Sarah Broom as well. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 877-217-5757. That's a toll-free dial anywhere you are, and you may reach us locally by dialing 297-5633 or via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Sally Nungesser, longtime Louisiana political operative, former press secretary to Governor David Treen, a Republican who handles candidates of note, including the Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden and Congressman Steve Scalise and John Fleming. Good morning to you, Sally.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And some folks told me you were spotted at the mayor's inaugural.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We cheered the new year, and he got inaugurated right after. It was part of a party that I was at. We rode around on a trolley and went from house to house eating and drinking and ended up in town square and watched the mayor get inaugurated.
That was special. Certainly a bipartisan spirit.
It was.
To start the year, Sally Nungesser cheering on Melvin Kip Holden, who starts term number three. Will you be going to the inaugural ball?
Actually, I am with a friend of mine who is a big supporter of the mayor's. I was not in this particular election, but I'm getting invited to some cool stuff. So,
two of your clients voted against the fiscal cliff
agreement,
Congressman Scalise and Fleming. Any surprise there?
No, I think they were disappointed that there were no spending cuts, and this actually increased the deficit. And I think both of them, they're pretty fiscally conservative guys, and I think that they were holding out for something better and hoping that maybe they could amend the Senate bill, but it was not to be. And so, but not surprised at all.
297-5633 if you'd like to join Republican Sally Nungesser. Now, David Vitter voted for it. Was that a surprise?
Yeah, a little bit of a surprise, but now he's in leadership. You know, he is he's now ranking member of a committee, which means that if we would take the Senate back, he would be chairman of a committee, which puts him right in the middle of the leadership. And so that may have had an influence on it. And then I did see his comments that he was very excited about finally making the Bush tax cuts permanent, and also taking care of another couple of issues that they did take care of in the fiscal cliff, which hopefully will make it easier for small businesses to feel confident about hiring and getting the economy moving. And so I think he did it based on that.
Well, there were a few Democrats in the Senate who voted against it, including Senator Bennett of Colorado. So is David Vitter becoming a leftist?
I doubt there's any danger of that. I also heard Nancy Pelosi this morning on the NPR show talking about how some people were disappointed on the Democrat side on the deal. So I guess that's the definition of a good compromise, when people are disappointed on both sides.
Well, the Speaker of the House could not get most of the members of his delegation to vote for the plan, enough to pass it, but not a majority. Mm-hmm. And now he is under fire, is John Boehner. Because he has stepped in the way of hurricane relief for the people in the Northeast. He is now, of course, switching gears on that after an outraged Chris Christie and others, including some members of his own House delegation, went up in arms about the Speaker's proposals. What's going on with Speaker Boehner?
Well, I think, you know, this was a tough vote that he asked the members of his party to make on the cliff. He actually, you know, put together enough Republicans. And that was a tough vote for them to make, and to ask him to make another back-to-back tough vote, I think was difficult for him. So he's just putting it off for a little while, and I don't think that the aid is stopping in the meantime. And I think some of the drama about putting that off a couple of weeks is unnecessary.
Do you think he's in any danger?
No, absolutely not. He's very smart. He's got a great staff. I've actually met him a couple of times. I've been fortunate enough to meet him a couple of times, and his staff is very good about working with all the members, and they're very humble people, and they talk to people, and that's a mark of a good leader to have a staff like that. And he's very charming and personable. And
seems like it. Did he cry when he met you?
No, I didn't see him cry. I saw him enjoy being in the French Quarter, though, and saw him enjoy a good glass of wine.
That's where you met him.
Yeah. It was at an event that we had in the French Quarter for Congressman Scalise at the Pentalba Apartments, and he enjoyed himself very much.
All right. Well, Scalise and Fleming, clients of Sally Nungesser, voted against the speaker for the fiscal cliff measure to avert the activities that would have happened if this had not been passed. Also voting against, of course, was Bill Cassidy, Baton Rouge Congressman, and Charles Bustani from Lafayette. 297-5633. We'll go to the phone lines in a bit with Sally Nungesser. She also represents Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden, and all signs are that he's ramping up for a run for governor. That election is 3 years away, but if he runs, the campaign would start much earlier than that, probably in about a year. So is he running?
I think that he would be a great governor. I certainly hope so. And I think that he is putting everything in place to do that, unless something would occur that would prevent him from doing it. I think that's where he's headed.
So he will run, no doubt, with others who are seeking that office. It is still as Doug Morrow used to call it, the big enchilada. Mm-hmm. Do you think David Vitter will run?
I think he's less likely to run now that he got this Plum committee assignment and seems to be moving up in leadership in the Senate. I think that makes him less likely to run, especially if he sees his way clear to being in the majority again soon.
But in Senator Vitter's case, if he were to run, it's a free shot for him, because even if he loses, he can come back the next year and run for re-election to the Senate.
Right, but you have to want to win.
That's true. Generally, you don't benefit from losing an election, but Mary Landrieu ran for governor in 95, and then a year later, she was elected to the U.S. Senate in a 5,788-vote margin over Lewis Elwood Woody Jenkins, who is 66 years old today.
Today.
Are you going to Woody's birthday party, since you're the gal about town?
I have not been invited to that particular event.
Well, Woody Jenkins, who composed the Ballad of Pete Maravich in 1970, is celebrating his 66th birthday. And tomorrow on this show, we will visit with Dan Bornay, speaking of Pete Maravich. He knew him well. And Pete died 25 years ago this Saturday. And also on the show is slated to be Charles Elson Buddy Romer III, the governor of Louisiana, who named the LSU Assembly Center in honor of Peter Press Maravich. Sally Nungesser with us. She was press secretary to David Connor Treen in 1983, 30 years ago.
Wow.
I was covering the race, and Sally was the press secretary for Dave Treen when he lost to Edwin Washington Edwards. Who would have thought that those two guys, who had probably the most intense campaign as far as real dislike for one another, would come together at the age they did, and Treen valiantly tried to get Governor Edwards out of jail?
You know, that's something that's a mystery to a lot of people, but if you really knew Dave Treen, he was very principled, and he really did that on principle. He thought that the justice system had not treated Governor Edwards fairly, and so it was just based on that principle, and that's who he was.
And he did not live to see Edwin Edwards get out of jail. Dave Treen was born in 1928, and he died before Edwards was released a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Edwin Edwards, who turns 86 in August, is reportedly on the brink of becoming a daddy once again. 86. His wife is 34. Sally.
The amazing modern science, isn't it?
Well, this is a story that I'm sure will generate attention for Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine the national media not biting into this one. This is too delicious a nugget of information not to. And Edwin Edwards, who has spent 1 out of 10 days in his life in jail, as he said when he went to jail in 75 and he got out at 83, people said, "You're going to jail for life." And he said, "I came out with a wife," and now he will soon have a baby.
That's just amazing. It's an amazing story, and I understand it's going to be on TV for everyone to watch with their own reality show. So that should be an interesting show. I'm sure we'll all be watching.
We had a listener who wanted to know or ask you about Governor Bobby Jindal's proposal to have women be allowed to buy birth control without a prescription, over-the-counter. He is proposing this. This is an interesting proposal, and especially so coming from conservative Governor Jindal. What are your thoughts?
Really haven't given it much thought, to tell you the truth, but I thought it was politically an interesting move on his part, and I'm all for trying to make, you know, all health care more affordable, and I think that that was part of the reasoning for making it available over the counter, and it doesn't seem like there's any logical reason why it shouldn't be. So,
well, the staunch pro-life Catholic Republicans say this would lower health care costs. This was in the Wall Street Journal, but there are those, of course, who are opposed to the governor's proposal, particularly on the right side of the political spectrum. Archdiocese of New Orleans Communications Director Sarah McDonald says, "We disagree with the governor's opinion because, as the Catholic Church teaches, contraception is always wrong." And the governor, of course, is a practicing Roman Catholic. Meanwhile, Planned Parenthood's president, Cecile Richards, says, "We completely agree that access to birth control should not be a political issue, and we welcome Governor Jindal's thoughtful contributions to the conversation on women's health." So Bobby Jindal getting plaudits from Planned Parenthood. Who would have thought?
That is very strange. But like I said, I agree with the governor and disagree with the Catholic Church that that it's a policy issue. It's not a religious issue in my mind, and I think it's good policy.
Well, Mary Landrieu was chided a few years ago when she, of course, continued her her pro-choice position on abortion, and the Church, including Archbishop Philip Hannon, the late Archbishop, denounced her. Even suggesting that she should be excommunicated. I wonder if some Catholic leader will now say that Governor Jindal should be excommunicated.
I think, yeah, I don't know. I'm not, as one of your listeners pointed out to me by email last time I was on the show, I'm not a policy wonk. I'm not, that is not something that interests me
Catholic,
very much, to tell you the truth.
You're not into the Catholic Church policy. Yeah. But the governor could get in some hot water in his church, and
he could. Yeah, I think it was a surprise. Mm-hmm. I think for most people, it was a surprise that he came out with that. And you know, it wasn't something he was put on the spot to do. It was something he voluntarily went out there and went against the church on. So it was surprising.
Is Mary Landrieu vulnerable next year?
Good question. And I think something that I think a lot of us in the party are talking about, whether it makes sense to run somebody against her and actually put one of our congressmen who are moving up in leadership and getting, you know, some seniority and all that, putting one of them at risk because they'll have to give up their congressional seat. Cassidy's talking about running. Fleming's talking about running. You know, to put that at risk in order to make another run against her because she has beat us heartbreakingly so several times now. So I think it is something we're talking about. I think she's less vulnerable, my opinion is. I think she's less vulnerable with the president being reelected because she does have access to him. And I think Louisiana voters are a little pragmatic about the fact that maybe we need somebody who can talk to the president in our delegation. So I think that makes her slightly less vulnerable, but we'll see.
We'll see, and we'll talk more with Sally Nungesser about 2014. That's appropriate. 297-5633 is your number. Back after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. What I said now. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 is your number. And if you were listening to Morning Edition this morning, you may have heard that Albert Arnold Gore, the man who won the popular vote for the presidency in 2000, former U.S. Senator from Tennessee, former congressman, and former vice president, is selling his current TV outfit to Al Jazeera. More than 40 million homes have access to it, and Al Jazeera is financed by an Arab government. The acquisition is, of course, going to be controversial. What's your take about this? Does this finish Albert Gore as a potential candidate for president at some point?
I don't know. I was speculating on what George Kennedy could do with that in a TV commercial. But, you know, it is Qatar. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
Qatar. You know, it's not, you know. I don't think it's
not welcome back, Qatar, either.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's, you know, somebody who's an enemy of the United States buying it. So it's
but
not
perception,
as bad as may have sound at first.
Perception is often difficult to get past. Now, Albert Gore, who was criticized as being a dummy when it came to the economy when he was running for president, has concocted this deal, and he will get $100 million as a result of his 20% ownership. So
he's done very well financially. He's doing
very well. Perhaps he's the kind of guy who is needed on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, you can't knock his business abilities and how he's parlayed a lot of. I think he parlayed a lot of the stuff with. Well, he was trying to do some things with energy to make a fortune. So he's done very well business-wise.
297-5633 for Sally Nungesser, who was press secretary to David Treen when Governor Treen was governor of our state from 1980 to 1984. And she was on the front lines 30 years ago when Edwin Washington Edwards was at his prime and won a... an election going away against an incumbent governor, one of the most bitter campaigns of all time in Louisiana gubernatorial history. Now, Kevin, do we have some cuts from some commentators? John Bolton, let's start with him. When Hillary Clinton had her concussion a few weeks ago, Bolton on Fox News basically said it was a head fake. Let's hear him.
When you don't want to go to a meeting or a conference or an event, you have a diplomatic illness. And this is a diplomatic illness.
And Laura Ingram, the well-known conservative commentator, chimed in like this.
You're a Roman Catholic, as am I, so we're now calling this the Immaculate Concussion. Because it's like it's a tree falls in the forest. Does it really fall if nobody hears it falls? did she really have a concussion?
All right, what do you think?
That's the kind of nonsense that people should keep their mouth shut on, obviously. you know, trying to say that somebody's avoiding going to Congress to testify and faking an illness. I think that would be horrible if anybody did do that. But
well, she is out of the hospital, front page of the New York Times this morning with the lovely Chelsea and her very lean husband, William Jefferson Clinton. She's 65 years old, apparently will make a full recovery. Mm-hmm. What about her in 2016? Do you think she'll run for president?
I think it's. I think that's fully her intention, according to James Carville. So I have to trust James, and I think that that's probably her intention. I think it's probably less likely that she'll win after how she went out. I think it was unfortunate for her. I think she had such a stellar time being Secretary of State. I mean, there was nobody, I think, that could have criticized her before the very end. So that was, I'm sure, not the way she wanted to go out.
Okay. 297-5633 is your number. Sally Nungesser is the guest. Kevin, I can't see the guests who are waiting. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, good morning to you, Phil. You're on with Sally.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I just want to say I'm one of your biggest fans, Ms. Nungesser, and what are your plans going forward and your advice to our beleaguered state here? Thank you.
Well, my plans are to try to get Jay Darden elected governor. I think, you know, when you look at him and his career path and his personality and his ability to work with people, I think that's probably what we're going to need in 3 years as a state. And I think he'll make a great governor. So that's my plans for the immediate future and to continue to support. Like I said, I've got two great congressmen who I work, I'm privileged to work for. Continue to help them progress in their careers is very important to me, too. So, but thank you. I appreciate that.
297-5633 for Sally Nungesser. Now, Governor Jindal has been criticized for spending much of his time out of the state. If Darden were elected governor, do you think he would do the same?
Only if it, you know, I think that he would have that perfect balance. You know, it, Mike Foster got criticized for not going anywhere when maybe there were some opportunities to promote the state out of the state. So I think Darden will be the perfect balance between the two. I think he'll be here a lot, and I think he will leave the state when it will benefit the state to be out of state.
Now, as stated, he will have a more difficult time than Governor Jindal did getting elected. I would think that there would be a stellar field of candidates, a lot of notables, including some Republicans. Mm-hmm. Won't be an open field for him by any means.
No, as it was not for Jindal in 2003 when he lost. I mean, that was another time that it was an open seat. I think any time the governor's seat is open, it attracts a huge field. And then a lot of people drop off because they're not able to raise the money, which, as you know, is what I help people do. So you've got to be able to have that ability to raise money very quickly if you're going to be a player in the governor's race mm-hmm. when it's an open field.
You worked for Bobby Jindal at one point, didn't you?
I did. I worked for him in 2003. I worked for him, got him elected to Congress in 2004, and then kind of stepped back and started taking on some other clients and when he was running for re-election in 2006.
Well, when he won in 2007, I recall a campaign event at Mike Foster's house, mm-hmm. and I saw Sally there.
Yeah, I did some special projects for him again in 2007, and helped him get elected then.
And I recall him telling his supporters who were there that he was an advocate of the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. and that he was appalled that Governor Blanco, in his judgment, his belief, had seized weapons from law-abiding citizens during Katrina, and that his response would be, if you loot, we shoot. The governor hasn't said anything, to my knowledge, about Newtown, Connecticut and what happened there. Is that a surprise, considering he is such a staunch gun rights advocate?
Well, I think Bobby Jindal is very smart about not commenting on things when he doesn't have anything new to add to the conversation. I think if somebody asked him about it, I think he would tell you he's still a very strong supporter of the Second Amendment.
Well, if somebody were to ask him, but he doesn't really make himself available to be asked about it.
Which I don't understand, because he's very smart and he's very personable when he wants to be, and very, he's great at talking to people. I really don't understand the isolation. I don't understand that part of the strategy, and nobody's bothered to explain it to me. But I don't understand that strategy, because I think he's a master at convincing you of going in his direction. I mean, I've seen him talk people into believing as he does.
He's very good one-on-one, and he's an extremely successful politician. Mm-hmm. You would think that it would benefit him to talk more, not less. Edwin Edwards used to run for the microphones. He loved it when he was questioned, because he felt he could win the day if he.
And if you remember, Mike Foster had a radio show
where he
took calls.
Live Mike.
Yeah, Live Mike. It was great. It made people feel very connected to him. And we're going through some tough times. And I think that just having him on air talking to people and saying things are going to be okay, you know, with the revisions that he's making, I think his policy is things that the Republicans in the state have been talking about doing for years, for decades, you know, on school choice, on dismantling and building a better hospital system for the poor and indigent. I mean, you know, these are things that we've been talking about doing for decades. And for him to not be talking to us while we're going through these major changes and saying, I got this, I think is my opinion is a mistake. I would tell him to start talking to us. I think he's great at it.
Here's a statement from Caroline online. She says, in another example of being out of touch with the reality of the economic landscape, President Obama has issued members of Congress a raise while negotiating the fiscal cliff. Now, would it be good if some of your clients said, you know, I don't want the raise. I'm going to give the money back to the Treasury. What do you think?
I don't understand that at all. And yeah, I think I don't understand. Well, Congress even talking about a raise and allowing this automatic raise. Yeah. Yeah, this automatic raise to go through. It seems like it would be a master stroke to say, we're just not going to take an automatic raise because things are not good with the deficit. And until we get something done on the deficit, let's not take the raise. I think that would be a great political move for them. But I do understand they set this up to be automatic years ago because they didn't want to have to vote themselves raises every couple of years, you know, to keep up with the cost of living. And I don't think they're overpaid. Let me just say
Well, let's talk about that. Members of Congress earn less than, say, the Secretary of Economic Development does in Louisiana and many other state officials. Mm-hmm. They do have to maintain two residences,
Absolutely.
Usually. So some would say that they deserve the raise.
Well, and like I said, if you're looking at what they earn for what they do, I don't think that they're overpaid. So that's not my concern. But I do think that with the deficit looming, I think it would be a good political move to just say, we're not going to take it. But nobody's asking me that either.
Alex says a far more concerning aspect of this issue about congressional pay is the fact that Congress people often cash in their chips and become well-paid lobbyists for the industries that they're regulating. Should there be a waiting period before they can jump on through to the other side?
That's a really difficult question. I think to deny somebody the ability to make a living after they leave the Congress, if they've been, you know, great public servants for 30 years and then they decide that they're going to retire, to tell them that there's certain things that they can and can't do, that's really difficult. But I understand the concern of maybe doing things at the end of your career that maybe aren't to benefit your constituents and aren't representative of what your constituents would want you to do because you are looking to the next job. So it's a real rough balance. But hopefully we're electing people of quality to Congress who would not make those compromises even to benefit themselves after they retire.
Well, several members of the Louisiana delegation have become high-paid lobbyists, both Democrats and Republicans. John Absolutely. Breaux, Bennett Johnston, Bob Livingston, Richard Baker, Billy Tozan. You could name. In fact, we probably have the all-star role of people who have accomplished this. Yeah. And some thought Mary Landrieu would do this. She has that opportunity, of course.
Yeah.
But she says she's going to run again.
I know. And I think a lot of people were surprised by that, especially with the president winning, that it would be an opportunity for her to move into a very lucrative spot. So I don't know.
Okay. Jennifer asked a question regarding your statement earlier that John Fleming, your client, was looking at running for the U.S. Senate against Landrieu. Mm-hmm. Does this preclude Bill Cassidy from running? Are we going to have two Republicans in the same race, or will there be a choice between Fleming, Cassidy, or another Republican?
I'm hoping that they, you know, would work it out because, like I said, they have to run at the same time. So they're going to both have to give up what they have earned by working very hard in Congress to get. Like, for example, Congressman Cassidy is on energy and commerce, very important to our state. Congressman Fleming is a subcommittee chair that has to do with fisheries, which also very important to our state. I mean, they've earned some positions that I think I'd hate to see both of them give it up, even if one of them was very successful and won the Senate seat. We are going to be giving up something when they do run. So I would hope that both of them wouldn't run because both of them can't win.
297-5633 in our remaining time with Sally Nungesser, Republican Politico. Richard asked about the votes that Jay Darden made in support of the Stelly plan. In fact, he was a floor leader for that plan. Will this come back to haunt him when he runs for governor?
I don't think so. I think they tried to do that to him as he's been running. I mean, as you know, he's been running for prior to this year. He ran 3 years straight, and I think every candidate who ran against him tried to make that argument. I think at the time, everybody thought Stelly was revenue neutral when they were voting for it. As a matter of fact, I raised the money to help promote the Stelly plan. When I worked for Governor Foster, and we all thought it was a very fiscally conservative thing to do, because what we were trying to do was we were trying to take a temporary tax on food and drugs that had been used as a political a way for people to politically get the state version of earmarks for their districts in order to vote to renew it every 2 years. And so we thought we were doing something very fiscally conservative and good for the fisc of the state. And no one at the time knew that it was going to be revenue neutral, revenue neutral. And so I don't think that it should hurt him.
Well, many of the budget woes that the state is having, including the cuts to higher education, could have been averted, cuts to health care, if Stelly had not been repealed.
Right. And I think what they should have done is they should have gone back and fixed it rather than repealed it, and fixed it so that it was revenue neutral, and so that it was, you know, but that it still had, and not totally repealed it. And I don't think we would be having the problems we're having now in the devastating cuts to higher education.
Nicholas on Nicholson writes, many of our members of our delegation miss sessions, yet they get paid, regardless if they're there or not. One way to make sure that they represent us on a continual basis is to deduct their salaries in proportion to their attendance.
I'm not aware that that's a really huge problem. I don't know. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm ignorant on this one. I don't know what he's talking about.
Well, I don't know if it's a huge problem with members of the Louisiana delegation, but, for example, when Bobby Jindal ran for governor, he was a congressman, so obviously he missed a lot of votes in 2007 because he can't be two places at the same time. You can't have a proxy on Capitol Hill. So there might be some merit to Nicholas's proposal.
An attendance tick sheet to get your paycheck. That's interesting. Well, a lot of people show up but don't really show up. So should we also have a quality test on how whether they're sleeping in the back of the room?
Some people you probably wish didn't show up and didn't vote.
And like I said, some people sleep through committee meetings. So
they do?
I don't know. Yeah, that happens.
Well, I think it is important to be on time and to vote when necessary.
And basically, you can stop their pay altogether. You just need to run against them next time, Nicholas, if you've got somebody that you've got particularly in your sights.
Well, it looks like there will be a congressional seat open with Bill Cassidy running for the U.S. Senate. I think he's going to run. So if that happens, Nicholas on Nicholson, I think he would be subject to running for the 6th District if he wished.
Right, for an open seat.
And he could say, if I'm not there, I won't take the pay. There must be a catchier way to say that.
I like the way you said it.
Well, thank you, Sally, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year, and hope you enjoy the mayor's inaugural this Friday, right?
Yeah,
Sally will be at the ball, along with many of her Republican and Democratic friends, as Kip Holden, the bipartisan spirit prevails with the mayor at Baton Rouge. Back after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Our guest at this time is Sarah Broom, who at the age of 26 is one of the Baton Rouge Business Report's 40 under 40. You had 14 years to do this, 14 more, and she is recognized for her work as the executive director of a group called Thrive Baton Rouge. What is Thrive Baton Rouge?
So Thrive is Louisiana's first charter boarding school serving at-risk students. And what we mean by that is students who need a little bit of extra support for a variety of reasons. Students come to us on Sunday night, and they stay with us through Friday night. And they go home, and they're home Friday night and Saturday night. So they're home over the weekend, but they're with us any night before they go to school. We run a pretty traditional school day. And then in the afternoon, they have life skills. They do their own cooking. They do their own laundry. They have chores that they have to do. They have time for homework. They also have time for art activities and physical sports, things like that. And then they have a pretty strict bedtime. You know, things are very set. There's a big routine, a big schedule. Right now, we just have sixth graders, but eventually we'll be a 6th through 12th grade school.
How many students are you working with?
So right now we have 17. When our students come back to us on Sunday night, we'll be adding three more for a total of 20, and that is our maximum enrollment for this year.
And how many employees?
We have a staff of 9 total. We have part of the staff works during the day, and then part of the staff is at night.
Well, Sarah, you came here as part of the Teach for America program.
Exactly.
And you were at Prescott Middle School.
I was a 2008 core member.
So you decided to stay.
I did. Was not originally in my plan, but fell in love with Baton Rouge basically the day I got here. So.
Well, that's good. Where are you from originally?
Cincinnati, Ohio.
And where did you go to school?
George Washington University in D.C.
Very good. And ended up in Baton Rouge, and you've been here now 5 years. So that's a commitment.
It's where I plan to stay for quite the foreseeable future.
Well, in the business report story about you for the 40 Under 40 feature, it says that one of your students was killed in 2010.
Exactly. I was at Prescott for 3 years, and this was during my third year of teaching, and there was a student who was killed in a fatal stabbing during a neighborhood street fight on a weekend. And she wasn't a student of mine, but she was at the school, and I taught both of her younger sisters. And while I'd sort of considered the idea of Thrive before, and it didn't have a name at the time, but that was really the motivation that sort of propelled it forward, that thought of we need to do more, that I'm not doing enough as a classroom teacher. No matter what I did, in that math classroom, it wasn't enough for some kids. And I needed an opportunity and a way to give kids unlimited opportunities.
Where is the school located?
We're at the Old School for the Visually Impaired, which is now the Family Youth Services Center, right on Government Street, which was at one point in time a boarding school. So it has all the dorm facilities that we need built right in.
Our guest is Sarah Broom. She is 26 years young, executive director of Thrive Baton Rouge, a charter boarding school for at-risk students planned. It's right at the edge of downtown. Now, what criteria is there for students being admitted to your school?
So we're a Type 1 charter school, which means that East Baton Rouge Parish authorized us, and we are a part of the East Baton Rouge Parish school system. And what that also means is that we don't have selective criteria. You have to be the right age to be in, or you have to be in sixth grade, and you have to live in East Baton Rouge Parish. But beyond that, there's no admission criteria because we are an open enrollment school. But what we do is we seek out guidance counselors, social workers, and different community groups in the area and say, this is the school that we have. This is the opportunity that we provide. Who do you think is a great fit for this school? There's a lot of different reasons why we're a great fit for kids. And sometimes it's hard to find those kids. And so using those community groups helps us to find them.
297-5633 for Sarah Broom from Cincinnati. Were you a Reds fan?
Not really. My whole family went to LSU, so we grew up being diehard Louisiana everything fans.
Okay, well, you could be a Reds fan and be a Louisiana LSU fan. But at any rate, we're glad you're here in Baton Rouge. And these kids that you're dealing with are those at risk. Last year, we had almost a record number of homicides in this area, in our community. And so I would think that many of these children come from impoverished backgrounds.
Yes, 100% of our students receive free and reduced lunch. 100% of our students are minorities. Nearly 100% of our students come from single-parent homes. So they are at risk on a number of different, in a number of different ways.
You say 100% are minorities. They're
100. We have 100% African American population.
100%, and
now again, that's of 17 students, so it's not
right. But of the 9 staff members, how many are African American?
Often 1, 2, 3. I have to think about that. 5.
Okay, and how do you interact with these kids? Do you find it a challenge, or is it something that comes naturally?
You know, I would say my first year of teaching, it was a challenge dealing with a lot of the behavior situations. But over the course of 3 years in the classroom, you really learn how to work with middle schoolers, which I think are the best group of kids to work with. They're definitely a special group of kids to work with. They, you know, go through the entire range of human emotion in about 20 minutes. And anybody out there who has a middle school child understands that sometimes they can be incredibly challenging to work with. You know, they scream at you that they hate you and you tell them that you love them. And it can be a different dynamic, but it's a very rewarding one because they're some of the most thoughtful, honest people you'll ever work with.
Now, you say eventually you want to go 6 through 12. Do
exactly.
you do that incrementally?
Yes, 1 year at a time. So next year we'll have 6th and 7th grade students, and then the next year 6th, 7th, 8th grade, and so on until we have all 7 grades.
Will you keep the children you have?
That is the goal, that the 6th graders we have now go all the way through 12th grade with us.
So eventually you may have to find a bigger space, I would think.
Yes, that is part of the long-term plan. We're very fortunate that the Family Youth Services Center is letting us rent the space that we have. There are also additional dorms that we can move into over the course of the next several years. So we are not in an emergency find a new space situation yet, but eventually we do plan to build our own campus.
You teach these young people how to conduct their lives, skills like what? Cooking?
Cooking is one of them, but it's a much bigger picture than that. It's a lot about independence and responsibility, which is a hard thing to teach a sixth grader. You know, it's teaching them you are responsible for getting your own laundry done, and these are the consequences if this doesn't happen. It's a very real world situation. We use a paycheck behavior system, so they literally get paid based on their behavior, and they use that paycheck to do things that they want to do, and it's a very real world situation. They have actual checks that they get at the end of each day, and so they're learning a lot of skills that that they'll need as they go on in life, and the level of skills that they're required to have increases over the years. So in sixth grade, it's a lot more hand-holding than we plan it to be in 12th grade.
297-5633. We have a question about the ability for people to find out more about Thrive. If they want to come to an office, what do they do?
Absolutely. You can visit our website at www.thrivebr.org, thrivebr.org. For safety reasons, you know, you have to have an appointment before you can come onto the campus since we do have students living there. But all of our contact information and ways to get involved are on our website.
During the week, if friends or family members want to see the kids, do they have that opportunity?
So we have structured parent nights where the parents and families can come in and see the kids, but we try to keep the schedule during the week very structured and very consistent. And so we try not to have the kids, you know, leave off campus or have other people come on campus because there's always something that students are supposed to be able to do. So if we have unexpected visitors, it pulls the students away from some sort of activity.
What happens on the weekend? You close the doors?
Not exactly. Most of our staff actually keeps in touch with the kids throughout the weekend. The majority of our staff visited all of the students during this Christmas break. We talk to them over the phone. We keep pretty well in touch with them. But, you know, it's a pretty full-time job to essentially be raising middle schoolers. And so I try and give my staff a little bit of a break during those 36 hours.
And it's the first of its type in our state, right?
It is. Well, there is the Mass Science School up in Natchitoches, but this is a school that really targets academically elite kids and focuses on those math and science. Ours is the first open enrollment, purely traditional boarding school.
So it's a groundbreaking endeavor here in Baton Rouge. Where do you get your funding?
So we get our funding from a variety of sources. As I said, we're a Type 1 charter, which means that all of our school funding comes through the traditional school funding means, which is the MFP, the Minimum Foundation Program. So we get paid just like any other school would get paid, which is on a per-student basis. The money for the residential piece has been donated by very generous community supporters. We've got a lot of really great local support that we've had to open, and we've had continuing on an ongoing basis to get open for next year, which has helped us to build our results and our credibility, which is allowing us to go for national funding sources.
When you were at George Washington U, did you think you would be involved in something like this a few years later?
Never. My goal was to be involved in politics, and I worked on the Hill for a year and decided that I wanted absolutely nothing to do with politics. So joined Teach for America and really just wanted to give back in a more very personal way.
What was your major?
Political science and nonprofit management.
And so on the Hill, what did you do?
I worked for Sherrod Brown as an intern and then a staff assistant.
Senator
Sherrod Brown. Yep.
Yeah. So, it must have not been an experience that was enriching.
No, it was wonderful to see. There were a lot of really intelligent people who I think got a lot of things done, but it was a very personal decision that I felt very disconnected from the people that I wanted to serve, and I wanted to be connected in a much more realistic way, which is what led me to Teach for America, which is, you know, as hands-on as you can get in serving your community. And from there, I just realized that education was always where I was meant to be.
Now we have a question about extracurricular activities. Do you encourage athletics and that sort of thing?
We do. It's a challenge when you only have 17 students or 20 students to have whole sports teams. Mm-hmm. But our students do play a variety of sports. We have a gym that we have access to at the center, which is fantastic. We have a field that we use for football and soccer. So our students do engage in all of those activities. We also have a partnership with Loop, which comes in and provides outdoor services for our students as well, and is going to take them on camping trips and things like that. So they do get a mandatory hour of physical activity time every day after school.
What's the breakdown regarding boys and girls in your school?
So we have an equal number of spots, 10 and 10. Right now we have 9 girls and 8 boys.
All right, so you're pretty close there. And they're all probably, 11 or 12 years old in that range?
For the most part, we've got anywhere from 11 to 13. Some will turn 14 towards the end of the year while they're with us.
And you plan on keeping the ones you have now for
seven years. 7 years, essentially, yeah.
6 through 12. And so next year, you potentially could have 40 students, right?
Actually, next year we're growing to have a class size of 30 in sixth grade, so our goal will be to have 50 students on campus.
50?
Yes. We started very small with 20. This was, as we said, a brand new concept. We wanted to make sure we did it well, we did it safely, and got down all the procedures that we needed to have this be effective. But now that we feel like we've gotten it underway and we've learned how to make it operate, we wanted to expand that number of students that have those openings. There are very few schools like this in the country, but SEED in D.C. is one that exists. And they have, you know, a massive waiting list. And we expect the same thing to happen once our reputation gets out there. You know, it was a little bit challenging this first year because nobody knew who we were.
Karen asks about your assessment of the governor's education reform package.
That's a question that I get pretty often, and this is the answer that I always give people is a very honest one, that opening this school has been the most challenging and time-consuming thing I have done in a very long time and expect I will ever do. And so I've really been focused on getting the school open and haven't been as focused on everything that's been going on education-wise in the rest of the state. But what I always tell people that I love about Louisiana, what's very different from Ohio, is that everybody here cares about education. No matter what your position is, you care about kids. And fundamentally, that's what's most important to us.
Well, you taught in the public school system.
I did.
What do you see as the biggest challenges?
To list them would take a very long time. I think that what Thrive tries to address is a holistic child. And that's where I think we fall short, is that education and the issues that come with it isn't one thing or another. It's a holistic problem and it requires a holistic solution. We provide for the academic, the social, emotional, and the physical well-being of our students. And all of those things are required for a child to be successful. And so coming up with solutions to all of those problems, you know, that's a very, very long list.
Mm-hmm. Have you found, Sarah, that some of the kids under your tutelage are not as receptive to Thrive as others?
Absolutely. You know, you have kids who, I don't want to clean my room right now. Now I want to go home because you're trying to make me clean my room. And of course that's going to happen. They're in middle school and you're making them clean a bathroom. Absolutely, there are going to be some kids who like it more than others. But at the end of the day, you know, every single one of our students that I've spoken to over the break or that our staff have spoken to have said they're ready to come back. They want to be there. But again, as any parent out there knows, you know, dealing with a middle school kid, it's sometimes mind reading because they never say exactly what they mean. You know, it can say, I hate you, I hate this place. And then the next minute it's, please, I want to stay, I love you. You know, they're just really challenging kids to work with sometimes.
Well, I would imagine like any other school, some children are more advanced than others.
Absolutely.
Okay. Here's a question about from John Rice asking, what did you think about Advanced Baton Rouge?
You know, I think being in a charter school, opening a charter school has given me a lot of perspective of how challenging it is. You know, I think a lot of people, you can look at it and say, oh, this is great. Let me open a school. And if I was in charge, I would do this, this way, and this, this way, and this, this way. And then you get into it and, it's so much more challenging than you could ever imagine. People often ask me, you know, if you knew how hard it would be, would you still go back and do it again? And I tell them yes, but I also say, you know, it's impossible to even conceptualize how hard this is. And so while there were a lot of things that I didn't agree with that went on with Advanced Baton Rouge, I have a lot more understanding of the challenges that they went through now than I did in the past.
Do you think people are averse to reform?
I don't think people are averse to reform. I think everybody wants what's best for our kids. And of course, that means that occasionally there are going to need to be changes. I think it's just the way in which we do it. We are trying something incredibly new here. You know, this idea of having kids stay over 24 hours a day, 5 days a week is as radical and different as you can get. And for the most part, we've had a huge amount of support from everyone.
Well, thank you, Sarah Broom of Thrive Baton Rouge. Good luck to you, and we look forward to an update sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.